Testing. This is Dave Crippen at the Essen Institute's Design History Center, the SLB4 Design History Center. And today is February 20th, and we're speaking with Mr. William Clay Ford, currently Vice Chairman of the Ford Motor Company. And this is, we are asking Mr. Ford today to review his career both with the company and before he went with the Ford Motor Company, in terms of design history and product development. And we'd like you to ask you, Mr. Ford, to start out with some of your earliest influences that you had in terms of being a member of a prominent automobile family, and the earliest influences on when you first begin to look at cars in terms of their design and their function.
It's difficult to pinpoint when you first became aware of the shape of cars and the design per se. Obviously, I was very young, as you say. I was brought up with automobiles constantly. It's all I ever knew. My father is well documented. Was very big on automotive design. I can remember.
Really almost a leader, you'd say.
Yes. But of course, as a kid, and I'm speaking probably when I was, 10, 11 years old, I wouldn't have had any idea whether he was a leader or whether, just what it was all about. I just happened to know that we had an easel at home and he painted and he sketched cars, and some of the sketches that he did were actually fabricated into automobiles, had custom body design. Several aluminum-bodied cars that I remember that were probably mostly in the, I guess you'd call them sports cars, in that they were two-seaters. Of course, in those days, everything had a long hood. That's really the things that I remember first, was the fact that he fiddled around with as I say, paintings and sketching, and that every once in a while in the driveway a new car would appear, which clearly was not a production car. So it was a hobby for him, if you will. And of course, later on I learned of the influence that he had, before I get to the Lincoln Continental, which was really the first time that I knew that what he was doing had some production capabilities. The rest of it, as I say, was more or less hobbies. I looked at the cars. I guess I was intrigued by them. I liked the sporty flavor that they had to them. I guess he knew that I was interested. He took me around when I was 12, 13 years old. We went to automobile races. We went to the old Roosevelt Raceway out in Long Island. We went over to England to the Brooklands racetrack, which I guess was demolished during World War II. I can remember driving around Brooklands, being fascinated with the MG, pre-war MG car, which to me was, and I might add still is, kind of the ultimate sports car. I mean, that's what a sports car was all about. And I think the design of that particular car was kind of the type of car that appealed to my father a great deal. There are parts of that you can see in the Lincoln Continental that he later worked on.
But there does seem to be an emphasis on sporty, even racing cars in your background as you grew up.
Well, and maybe that's a throwback to my grandfather, to his racing, literally racing days.
Yes, right.
I think speed, race cars. We, as you know, the company back in the 30s got into the race car business.
And you were down there at one time.
Yes.
I have a picture of you with Preston Tucker.
Yeah. Well, I remember, I'd say the first time my father took me to Indianapolis was 1936, so I was 11 years old at the time. And those were in the days when they had riding mechanics. There were two people in the car, and, you know, so there was a fascination with me from, you know, way back then for design of cars, for speed, for, well, all the things that, that you know, are part of well, sports cars and, I don't know, the things that go with racing.
Yeah, well, I think it's a natural outgrowth of an adolescence that you had, that cars and then speed would be a, would be a fascination.
And, well, needless to say, he sort of spoiled me rotten. He gave me, my sister and I had, were given small cars, maybe when we were about 10 years old, that were, they were gasoline powered, but they would, well, probably 8-10 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they were a lot of fun, and the trick was to see which one you could make faster than the other one. So, you know, I learned to fool around a little bit with engines at that age, trying to get an extra half mile an hour out of it so I could go faster than her car would.
Could you drive around Gawker Point, or could you get out on Lakeshore Drive?
Well, in those days, you could, you could get out on Lakeshore Drive. Yeah. I mean, we were in Land's End out there. Right. There was no development or anything, and Lakeshore Drive was a pretty isolated place, but fortunately, there was a lot of property out there.
Yeah.
And also, we would, the cars, don't ask me how they got there, but they ended up at his place in Fairlane out in Dearborn.
We've seen some pictures of those.
Yeah, and we would drive them around there.
Right.
And good Lord, they were even over at the in the Rouge. We well, we drove around the Triple E building, you know, back to the museum there.
Mm-hmm.
And
lots of room out there.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think, and from there, I my, speaking personally, I think my the next vehicle that I got was a midget race car in the true sense of the word. It was I think an English engine. The body was made in Indianapolis, I believe, and he put a governor on it. It was supposed to keep me to 30 miles an hour, and I think it took me roughly 10 minutes to figure out how to get the governor off. I never let him know that, that I knew how to take the governor off it, but and that came off pretty regularly when he wasn't around. Mm-hmm. And all my friends would drive it. We had I went and bought a whole set of racing flags that, you know, like they had at Indianapolis, and stopwatches, and we'd time each other racing around my family's place out in Grosse Pointe.
It was about 1939, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I think that's when I got it. I think I was 14 years old when I got the car. And, well, that car's still in existence.
But, is it really?
Yeah.
You still have it?
I don't have it. It was in a museum for a long time, and what's happened to it since then? It wasn't too many years ago that I saw it over there in the museum.
Trying to find it.
So it was, you know, it was still lying around. I remember one particular recollection is that I brought it out to the test track out here in Dearborn one weekend when my family was away. Took it out on the track, took the governor off, got it going a little over 100 miles an hour, and got the governor stuck with wide open throttle.
How did you get out of that one?
Well, that caused no end of consternation around the track, and I got to admit it, well, it taught me how to drive pretty fast. Rather quickly. I mean, I was driving fast, but I learned how to handle a car in a very short period of time.
Al Esper at the track in those days?
Pardon?
Do you remember Al Esper?
Yeah, I remember. I don't know whether Al was around there then. The guy that arranged it for me was Ray Dallinger.
Of course, yes.
And I remember calling up Ray and saying that my family was out of town. I thought it'd be a good time if I took the car out to the test track out in Dearborn. Poor Ray, I guess, was caught between a rock and a hard pile. So, okay, fine, you know, bring it out. And I remember he was standing there. And I really don't remember whether it was Esper or who was, you know, connected with the track at that time. But they were pale as ghosts when I finally came roaring in down the straightaway. Had the car in neutral and was trying to brake it without skidding it. Brought the thing in, and here's the engine stuck wide open, and this thing's going 100, 110 miles an hour. And it might well have been Esper, because somebody said, congratulations, I think you just set the new track record. And I said, yeah, wonderful. So
Al just died a couple of months ago.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know.
He was about 87.
Yeah, I would imagine he must have been.
Delightful guy.
Well, my family didn't find out about that.
Good.
Yeah, that was fine. They didn't find out till, 6-8 months later, I guess. there was all hell to pay when they found out, but luckily I'd walked away from it, so everything was fine. But, you know, so I guess I go back to racing and speed, and my love for race cars in Indianapolis, as I mentioned, Brooklands in England and Roosevelt Raceway, and I still follow it. Mm-hmm. And
fascinating sport.
It's a fascinating sport, and I think there's a direct tie-in between automobile racing and production cars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, both in design and in features that have been developed through racing. So it fascinates me. I guess after the midget racer, there was a car that you alluded to earlier, which was a sports car that was sort of like an MG in design. It had the...
How'd that come about? You got a little case history on that?
I was just trying to think how it came about. No, not really. My father was full of surprises. This just arrived on a Christmas or birthday. I'm not sure which it was. And it was similar design to the MG. It had the doors that curved down and that kind of thing you rest your arm on.
Yeah.
And of course, it wasn't as hot as the midget racer. It didn't have the performance. As a matter of fact, it really didn't handle very well. It wasn't all that safe, but it was a very fancy looking car.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he was pretty proud. Well, I was, you know, I was in seventh heaven.
Mm-hmm.
But I know the looks of it appealed to him.
I suppose at this point it might be instructive to talk a bit about your father. Obviously, a very benevolent and affectionate relationship with your father that you had.
Right.
And while he may have indulged you, I suspect he was strict where he had to be.
Yes.
And fair when he had to be.
Yes.
Yeah. In terms of your relationship with him and in terms of maybe a long-term look at the history of automotive design, did anything stand out in your adolescence before his death as to his feelings about design, his sensitivity to design?
Well, I think I was really too young, mm-hmm. I don't think I know I was,
yeah.
to, you know, have been involved in, you know, any of the discussions on changing a Model T to a Model A and those kind of things. Speaking personally, the earliest recollections that I have really were the Lincoln Continental in the late 30s.
That must have been a vision to a young man's eyes.
Well, it was, it was a custom car. I mean, the story's been, you know, very well documented, and it happens to be true that, you know, I think he built it for himself, and I think he was going to build, I understand, two others, one for my brothers,
mm-hmm.
I mean, one each for my two older brothers. And I remember driving the original one.
Were you down there that winter?
Yes, I was down in Florida, and that's when I took it. And I took a date out in the thing, and
mm-hmm.
it was an awful car to drive. I shudder to think how much the thing weighed, but good Lord,
a ton.
Yeah, literally, it was. I remember driving up to a little town called Stuart, Florida, which was 20 some miles away from where we were down there. And it took about a mile to stop this car after you got it up to about 65 miles an hour. I mean, the brakes were totally inadequate. I don't know how much lead there was in the thing, but it was really a lead sled all the way around.
Right. I understand it leaked like a sieve, too. It's not in the range cone down there, no?
You know, I don't remember that part of it.
Yeah.
All I remember was the brakes. The brakes stand out in my mind, maybe because my addiction to speed again. I was probably driving it a lot faster than it should have been driven. And I do remember going down this road, which is a pretty desolate road, but as approaching the town of Stuart, when more cars appeared, that, you know, obviously I'd figure, well, I better start slowing this thing down. I had my hands full, and I don't know what the turning radius on it was, but I remember just turning the thing around was a major achievement.
No power steering.
No power steering. No, and it. Well, needless to say, it wasn't ready for production, but it was an eye catcher.
It did excite a lot of comment.
Oh, no question about it. No question about
your
it.
Your father's friends all and wanted.
They looked at it and gee, I've got to get one of those. And you know, as I say, it's one story that's not apocryphal. I mean, he literally came back from that vacation with orders galore from,
right.
And you know what the corporate decisions were to make it into a production car, I have no idea. I never knew what really went on out here in Dearborn.
Does that stand out in your mind as probably the terms of aesthetic quality, one of the better ones that came out of that show.
Absolutely, so, absolutely. Yeah, the more
especially in its 40 and 41 inch.
Yeah, exactly. The more I look at it, and I've got a 39 Ford station wagon at home that I drive and take the grandchildren out.
Oh yeah.
And the grill on that is reminiscent of the grill that was on the Lincoln Continental, and it's a functional grill. It's simple, and yeah, it's one of the prettiest grills that I think's ever been put on a car. And I don't know, the more you examine that car, I think the more you appreciate, the feeling that went into designing it. I mean, there's nothing production or, just run of the mill about it. There was thought that was put into every detail of it. And that is the highlight, there's no question. That car is the highlight in my mind.
The aesthetics behind it seem to have come out of a very interesting matrix. I've talked with Bob Gregory, your father's old designer, who's still lively in his 80s. He's fantastic, and he said that Edsel Ford would come over to the design shop in the Tripoli building almost every day, and they would talk informally and. They would change ideas, and Bob Gregory would sketch. He was great at quick sketches.
Right.
And that your father would say, "Oh, I like that, and maybe we could do this," and then they'd do some more sketching, more talking. He said, and out of that rather seemingly casual matrix came the design that he liked, the Continental. He'd come back from Europe.
That's right.
And
that's right.
Seen a couple of designs he liked, the contemporary designs, and so it's instructive to me that this marvelous catalytic relationship between he and his chief designer. It came up seemingly casual, but not so casual. Came up with this marvelous automobile.
Well, of course, as you know, and I'm sure as Bob Gregory told you, I mean, automotive design was a pretty low echelon
in
the corporation at that time. It came under engineering, and it was way down in the pecking order of things that engineers did.
Right.
And there's no question. I mean, I do remember, being in Europe with my father, and he would look at, all these cars with a very appreciative and a very critical eye.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, he took the best features of the cars that he saw over there and incorporated them into the Continental. I mean, this would go good in this kind of car.
Well, it's certainly a classic design, and still today it looks fresh and exciting.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's that's the test right there. If you can look at it today and it still looks like a car you'd like to drive.
Right. Well, shortly, the year of your father's death, I believe you enlisted into the Naval Air Corps.
Correct. Yeah. Right, 1943.
Where were you first assigned? How did that go?
Well, I unfortunately, just before I went into the Navy, my father died, so he was never around when I was in the service.
Mm-hmm.
And I started out in Ann Arbor, and at the time I enlisted in the Naval Air Corps, they were looking for flyers, very badly. So
yes.
I guess everybody rushed down and enlisted.
Were you in the V-5 program on that?
I was, exactly, exactly. And, typical. First there's a shortage, then they enlist everybody, then they got a glut. And
same thing happened to me.
Okay.
Yeah,
so right. as a way of killing time, I got sent out to Ann Arbor, and I spent a scholastic year out there, 8-9 months, I guess. And then I went all over the country, Floyd Bennett Field, I guess I went next, New York, and then I went out to St. Mary's pre-flight in California, and
right.
I spent about 6 months out there, and then I went to Ottumwa, Iowa for primary flight training, and
right.
Glenview, Illinois, and then, eventually the war ended, and I got out shortly after that, so.
Similar experience, So there you were, about 1945, you'd only finished high school as a 43,
did you? Yeah, the doctors told me, and I think it's probably true, that my father, medically speaking, probably should have died about 3 weeks before my graduation from boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he kind of willed himself alive, if you will,
mm-hmm.
till the day I got home.
Mm-hmm.
And I came home and I'd won the school tennis championship, so I had my trophy and I had my diploma, and about 2 days after that, he died. I mean, I had no idea really up till, good grief, but the day before I graduated from school, that he was that critically ill. And I really thought he was going to be up for my graduation. And then I got a handwritten letter from him saying that, you know, he was laid up and wouldn't be able to make it. And then my mother called and said she wouldn't be able to make it. And my sister and her husband came up. And they told me what the real story was. And they said, you know, we're going home, no airplanes. We're catching the old Detroiter train that night. So we caught the thing from Poughkeepsie, New York, and went right on home. And, you know, I saw him, and as soon as I walked in the house the next morning, I mean, he was in bed, but he was very coherent. We had a fine discussion.
Oh, yeah. That's wonderful.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, that part of it was great. Mm-hmm. And he congratulated me on, you know, whatever I'd done.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fine, but then about two days later, he passed away.
Very sad.
And as I say, the doctor said, you know, if it hadn't been for this particular event, he probably would have gone 3 weeks before that. He had no business living as long as he did.
It's a marvelous story. So you decided to enter university, and how did you happen to pick Yale?
Oh, that's strange, because I can't answer the question. I'd always wanted to go there.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since,
really?
Since I was sick. Yeah, Henry had gone to Yale, but but that had no bearing on it.
Yeah.
I mean, long before Henry ever went to Yale, I don't know. I just, mm-hmm. as a kid,
sure.
you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, I've always wanted to go to Yale.
Oh.
I have no idea why. I just
you spent a delightful 4 years there.
Oh, yeah. wonderful time. You know, looking back, probably the best time I ever had anywhere. I had add to the confusion or whatever of, you know, going to college after the war. I got married after my sophomore year there.
Wow.
And our first kid was born up in New Haven.
Really?
Yes. She was born...
Martha?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she was christened in the Battelle Chapel on the old campus up there. And the dean of the college that I'd lived in before I got married was the one who christened her.
No.
So... I don't know. I mean, I really can't tell you, you know, why I went to Yale, except it was the one place I always wanted to go. I think I would have been very disappointed if I hadn't gotten in there. Just before, you know, going in the Navy, we'd taken entrance exams and everything else for college.
Right.
And I'd been accepted in Yale, so I knew that after the war that everything worked out okay according to plan, but that's where I'd be going.
As I recall, in my experience, I got an awful lot of credits when I came out of the Navy.
Yeah.
I was practically a junior. practically a sophomore.
That's right.
There, yeah.
That's right.
Did you belong to any clubs or organizations there that you recall?
Yeah. Yeah, I was a member of the Fence Club, which is, it's a defunct branch of SIU fraternity, which is a national fraternity.
What was the name again?
It was called the Fence Club.
The Fence Club.
Fence, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was your traditional college fraternity.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then Yale has a peculiar system that they've been fighting for 100 years, which will probably go on for the next 100 years, of something called senior societies.
Mm-hmm.
And you're elected to those if you're elected. Unfortunately, when I was there, there were 6 of them, and they only took 15 kids each spring.
Mm.
So that isn't very many out of a, you know, class of 1,500 or whatever it was at that time, 1,000 plus. And I joined a senior society called Wolf's Head. And
what's it called?
Wolf's Head.
Wolf's Head, yes.
And a lot of my friends that I still see today were members of mm-hmm. the same delegation at Wolf's Head, or were in prior delegations, and I've had a very close affinity with a lot of those. So that's probably the one part of college that's kept up through the years. Mm-hmm. I do see
good
members of that senior society.
What did you major in college? I've forgotten.
I majored in, I got a Bachelor of Science degree in Applied Economics.
Oh.
And I started out as an engineer. Kind of lost my taste for that, I would guess, about just starting out my junior year. I'd always done a lot of athletics in college.
Right.
And I played on the varsity tennis team and the varsity soccer team, which was great. I loved it, but it was also pretty time consuming.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, I mean, the engineers had a pretty tough curriculum. Mm-hmm. And there were too many labs and too much time, and I thought, well, and I wasn't particularly all that captivated by engineering anyway. I mean, once I got into it, the more I got into it, the less I really enjoyed it. So I transferred over to the applied economics course, and that I really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
And well, fortunately, all my engineering credits applied to that.
Okay.
But I got a chance to take a more liberal arts kind of an education for the last year and a half, two years. I was delighted I had. I mean, the courses I think that have served me best post-college have been the liberal arts courses that I took.
The stories I remember is that you were definitely scheduled to come with the company as soon as you got out of Yale, and you did. You took a vacation, I think.
Yeah, I took about a month off. No more than that.
Are you talking about grouse shooting in Scotland?
Oh, that was later on.
Was that later?
Yes, that was later on. No, I graduated, well, as you know, things got screwed up during the war.
Right.
And graduations came at weird times.
Yeah.
I happened to graduate in February.
February 49, right?
Right. Yeah. And I came to work the next month, in March.
Mm-hmm.
So my service date goes back to March of 49. But, you know, there was never, you know, I've been asked in the past, you know, when did you decide that you would work for the Ford Motor? Well, I mean, there wasn't any decision.
I mean,
I don't mean that anybody forced me to. I mean, nothing had ever crossed my mind other than working for Ford Motor Company.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it was no decision that I made. It was perfectly logical that...
It was assumed, and you assumed it.
Oh, yeah. And I really don't know whether everybody else assumed it or not. I just in my own mind, that's sure. what I was going to do. And, you know, so... As I say, after about a 3-week vacation after college, I was ready to go to work at the company, and it was fine.
Was there any sort of family discussion or family conference with your mother or with Henry as to what you might do initially and how you might break in?
No, I had a preconceived notion. Don't ask me where I got it. I got it at Yale. That's where I got it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had a very good, I guess, political science teacher.
Who's that?
Good Lord, sorry you asked me his name. It'll come to me in a minute.
Certainly.
And I, for some reason, I thought that industrial relations would be the
mm-hmm.
field that I wanted to get off in. And when I first started out with the company, Henry, correctly, you know, thought that I ought to get a pretty general training program
mm-hmm.
in you know, all aspects of the company, or at least as many as I could. And I started out in sales and advertising.
I have a picture of you at that point. Forgotten it.
Probably have.
You and
Jack Davis was your first mentor.
He
was my first mentor, is correct. Yeah, that's right. Good Lord, I haven't seen this thing.
So I started out working for Jack.
That's right.
Now Jack had been a mentor of Henry's, or at least a good friend and a good.
I guess Henry got him back from Siberia after he'd been in exile.
Funny story, California.
Right.
But apparently he thought then that would be a good place for you to start as well.
Yeah, that was on my agenda. So that was March, and then June. John Bugis, who was then head of what was called industrial relations.
Right.
We had a collective bargaining agreement coming up in that September, and negotiations were beginning.
Big one was there.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And he thought it would be good if I got put on the bargaining team and became a part of that group. So I've talked it over with Henry, and you know, it seemed fine, John. Mm-hmm. Talked to him, and so I joined the industrial relations team then in June of that year, and stayed with that through the end of September, I guess, when we signed the contract.
How was that experience? Did you find it instructive?
Yeah, it was wonderful. It was probably the most taxing mm-hmm. experience that I've had in
really long hours. Yeah.
Long hours, and for me, you know, a neophyte, mm-hmm. Fresh out of college, I was a pretty good target for those UAW sharpshooters.
Sure. Yeah.
And,
Walter was.
Which was a great experience because Walter was there. You know, there aren't too many people around today who have actually sat across a bargaining table from Walter Reuther, and I was fortunate enough, if that's the right word, to have had that experience.
Adversarial though he was a marvelous person.
Yeah, he was, and he was a spellbinder. He was a little loose with words, and yeah, something that he'd tell you one day might not apply the next. But I had a very good relationship with him, as I did with the other members of the UAW bargaining team. There was Ken Bannon was head of the whole Ford group, and I still talk to him. He calls me up. Oh, we've got a pretty good relationship still. I got him tickets for the Super Bowl game a couple of years ago, and a fellow named Gene Prado was at a local 600 at that time. He since died. But at any rate, I felt I was really under the gun the whole time in the negotiation period. Great experience, really tough hours. Towards the end, we were going literally around the clock, and we were going 7 days a week, and it was tough.
In this regard, Mr. Ford, was John Bugis a good teacher, a good friend, and the one who broke you in into labor and the labor relations, industrial relations field?
John was wonderful. He was he was another father to me.
Mm-hmm.
He looked out for me. He kept me under his wing, and he and a man named Mel Lindquist, who was John's right-hand man, between the two of them, I got, they made sure I didn't get in too much trouble, and nobody picked on me too badly, and as I say, the whole thing was a great learning experience for me, a tough one, but a really good one.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I continued work in industrial relations for a little bit under Mel Lindquist.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, during that period, my love affair for industrial relations really started to cool off. I thought, you know, if you have to come into work every day and the only thing you have to look forward to is the number of complaints that people have gotten, after a while, it was a Chinese water torture. It's not much fun just coming into work and listening to complaints all the time. So I'd had my experience. I was glad I went through it. It was a good experience. I still cherish it, but I wouldn't want to do it.
So how did you get out of it? Did you just say to Henry, I'm looking for
it? Yeah, I said okay. I've done that. Yeah. You know, that's enough. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to something else.
Yeah. He got you into the was it the new jet engine?
Yeah, it was.
That you were working on?
Yeah.
The J what?
Oh Lord, I don't know. Was it Westinghouse?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was the designation.
Yeah, J-50 or something.
Yeah, and for some reason I ended up in quality control on that, which somebody thought would be a good experience for me in manufacturing. I really wasn't very happy with. First of all, it was not automotive. It might have been a pretty good exercise in engineering. But
you hark back to some of your engineering.
Yeah, and I, you know, some of the things that I had learned were applicable, but it really wasn't the kind of thing that turned me on. During this time when I was in the Lincoln Mercury thing, Ernie Breach, from time to time I'd come over to the old rotunda and have lunch with him over there.
Right.
And not very often, maybe half a dozen times a year. But oddly enough, quite a few times, and it really wasn't for my benefit, Ernie Breach would bring up the old Lincoln Continental.
Mm-hmm.
You know, gee, I wonder if we ought to bring that car back. There'd been a lot of demands, and I guess he was getting letters.
Right.
And
there'd been a sort of a half move in that direction in resurrecting the facelifted ones just after the war.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And you know, those aesthetically, those really didn't appeal to me a whole lot.
No.
The post-war jobs, they were. Well, I mean, first of all, the front end was, you know, it was just too much. I mean,
right.
It was massive, and it was totally incompatible, as far as I was concerned, with the rest of the sheet metal that went on the car. But this was just a nebulous idea in his mind. I don't think he really had any thoughts as to how to go about doing it, if it should be done at all. But we would talk about it.
Yeah.
And,
you
know,
I
it did. I kind of perked up at that. And he obviously sensed that I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, gee, you know, that'd be kind of fun to, you know, if you decide, you know, to go come out with another Continental, it'd be kind of fun to get involved with it. I really didn't know in what capacity I'd be involved, or if at all, or there would be anything. And this went on for, gee, oh, I would guess, couple of years, maybe a year and a half. Very informal discussions. And we were talking about, you know, whether we should make the bodies out of plastic, if it was going to be a low volume car, whether that was the way to go.
You were thinking of it still as a luxury low volume car at that time?
Yes, without having really any, the whole thing was so nebulous. There was no plan. It was, well, if we do, maybe we should, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always that if. But I, you know, I kept it filed away in the back of my mind as something that, you know, I thought would be appealing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember one day, I have no idea what triggered it on his part, but he just, you know, flat out asked me, would you like to head up a project like this? And I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. I couldn't wait for it. I thought that'd be nifty. So paper was prepared. It was called the Davis Report.
Jack Davis.
Jack Davis
drew up a sort of a perspective.
Well, he was the tour director of the thing.
Okay.
Bob McNamara had a lot of input on it from finance staff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who all the signatories were to the thing. I'm sure there's a copy of it floating around someplace, but. R.J. Miller, there were a lot of them that you know, had some input on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a paper that said that a project should be undertaken,
mm-hmm,
to look at the feasibility of coming out with another Continental.
Mm-hmm.
So that piece of paper was kind of my mandate.
About what date was that? Late 51, maybe?
Yeah, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Late 51. I was, you know, Ernie said, okay, you know, this is it, see what you can do with it.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't think, and properly so from his point of view, he held out a whole lot of hope for me that I was going to come up with much. I mean, I was awfully green. I'd had no experience in anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he could tell that I was, you know, interested by it, more than that, fascinated by it.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be a pretty good place for me to cut my teeth, and I guess I really couldn't mess things up too badly, no matter what I did. So with that, I was told, okay, you've got one employee who turned out to be Harley Cobb. And you know, go figure out where you're going to do it, how you're going to do it, what it's going to look like, and you know.
Harley Cobb, in a sense, was your body engineer.
Yeah.
Design.
Yeah, Harley was, after I was given the project, Harley was my only employee for
right.
a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of us would, you know, sit down every day, figure out, well, number one, where were we going to put this group together?
Mm-hmm.
We ended up in the old Henry Ford Trade School, which was then stuck in the woods out here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, off Michigan Avenue, off a little dirt road that came in off Michigan Avenue. It was a, you know, a very attractive, nice white wooden building, and
had been the naval used by the U.S. Navy during World War II, as I recall.
I think that's right. I think that's right.
Yeah.
But it was in, well, semi disrepair.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, you know, it was kind of a mess, but there was enough space there. And we took what was the gymnasium, and that became our design studio. We laid out some plans of office space and one thing and another, and Harley was more familiar with personnel than I was. Clearly we needed engineers, and clearly we needed designers.
Had you come up with the term special products yet by this time? Or didn't you have a name for it before?
I think once we physically got located in the trade school, I think we became Special Product Operations. Who gave us that name, I don't know. I'll give Ernie Breach the credit, because he was kind of the guy who was behind the whole project. I don't think we dreamt it up. As time went on, we tried to make a mystery out of, you know, what Special Product Operations is all about. That's right. This was our Manhattan project that we had going on there. And Harley found John Reinhart.
Had John been with the company, or had he been with
I think company? John may have had some prior experience with the company. Yeah. I don't think at that time he was. I think he was with Packard.
Right, he was.
And where Harley knew him, I don't know. Okay. I was never too clear on that. But he told me, he said, I'd like you to, you know, interview John Reinhart. He said, I think he's the kind of person that, number one, you'd work well with, and secondly, he's done work on classic cars like the old Packards. And he said, you know, if this is the kind of car that we're going to be doing, he's had experience with that kind of machine. So
he's been a Studebaker also.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So John, John came in, and we hit it off. First second he came in, he was very low key. I liked the way he talked. I liked his ideas of the kind of car that we were going to build. I liked everything about him.
He was a delight.
Oh yeah, yeah, and you know, had great taste, and he had a lot of the more I think about it, he had a lot of the personal traits that my father had.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very kind man. He wasn't a screamer, a table pounder, or anything else. He was very reserved, quiet, dignified.
Mm-hmm.
And had great taste.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean that was great as far as I was concerned.
And Harley Kump had recommended him and had accompanied him also.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And I remember Earl McPherson was the vice president of engineering at that time. And I remember going over and talking to Mac and asking what kind of help I was going to get with this thing. And he said, well, I'm giving you a bright engineer in Harley Kump, and he said, you're going to have to scrounge around and put the rest of it together yourself.
It must have been a bit daunting.
Well, it was. I mean, the whole thing was a challenge from the word go. I mean, there was nothing. When I look at the programs and the product programs that we go into today and the thought that goes into them before we undertake them, this was, I mean, this was hit and miss and a wing and a prayer all the way.
That was the last time that really happened.
I think so. And as you know, we became a totally autonomous group. I mean, I think maybe the first inside the Ford Motor Company where we had our own purchasing, our own manufacturing, our own design staff. We had everything. We were totally decentralized.
An enclave.
Yep.
Within the structure of the company.
Yep.
What did Henry think of all this? Was he supportive?
Yeah, he was supportive. I don't think he knew really what we were doing over there, and I'm not saying that we did either. he knew that I was, you know, busy doing something over there, and that we had a timetable of when we would have sketches and or clay models to show them. We'd obviously laid this whole thing out, and we'd laid out an introduction date, and then, you know, working backwards from there, we built an assembly plant. We had to look at, what components, and this was, I mean, I don't take any credit for this was Harley's doing, what components from existing Lincoln or other cars could be used if any. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he designed a unique frame for this car to lower it down to 56 inches, which was unheard of in those days.
Right.
I mean, this was about, well, 6 inches lower than the regular car that was on the streets. And still make it comfortable, and mm-hmm. still give it the feel and the luxury that the original Lincoln Continental had. Mm-hmm. So he designed this cowbelly frame in the thing. We took the Lincoln engine. We took a lot of the components, the drivetrain, but we modified a lot of things too, and. Sheet metal, of course, was totally unique. The wheelbase was unique. We fooled around with, I hate to think of the number of hours I spent in that gymnasium with John Reinhardt and the staff that he put together, mm-hmm. a lot of whom are still in the design center. I say a lot. There maybe as of 5 years ago, there were a lot of them are starting to retire now. Mm-hmm. But there are still, you know, quite a few of them that that worked on that project.
When did Gordon Geary come into the project?
Oh, Gordon came in, I'd say about a year after we'd gotten underway.
Oh, okay.
And yes. Interesting, Harley gave me, I knew the name, sure. Gordon Geary.
The Gordon,
so. Yeah, I didn't know Gordon personally. Mm-hmm. And Harley told me, I'm hiring Gordon as a body engineer. And he said, but I've told him he's got to stay out of the design studio. And I said, well, what's the problem? And he said, well, he says, you know, Gordon, he's designed cars in the past, and he's going to want to design this car. And he said, I don't want him to design this car. I want him strictly as a body engineer. Mm-hmm. And he said, I've made him promise he would stay out of the design studio. Well, Gordon did. I mean, of course, Harley's a pretty forceful guy, even though he's very young. he still had a way of getting things across. And Gordon, he knew that, you know, if he ever stuck his nose in there, that he'd be looking for a job someplace else. So Gordon came aboard, really, he's just body engineer. John Reinhardt hired a fellow named Bob Thomas as his right-hand man. And then the design group kind of grew from there. Bob, I still correspond with Bob. He's just written a couple of books, as a matter of fact. Yeah, and you know, Bob was great. He was a good designer too. Fortunately, personality-wise, he and John got along great. From a design point of view, they were different, and that was fine. So we had a couple of different schools there that you know, were able to express themselves. And really, the car that we ended up with was kind of a marriage of really all of our ideas, the three of us and Harley too. He had a lot of input in it. Mm-hmm. So it was really, you know, John, Bob, Thomas, and Harley and myself that kind of put our best thoughts together and came up with what eventually turned out to be the car that got put in production. Harley knew a lot more about the inner workings of the company than I did, and he knew about the politics that went on. And he, when it came time for our, we were making periodic reports back to the, I guess it was called Executive Committee, I don't remember, but awesome. Ernie Breach and, you know, Henry and some of the other people, we were giving them progress reports that we were coming along and that we thought we had a design, although we had not showed it to them. That we had a design that we thought was going to, you know, satisfy what Ernie and the rest of them were looking for and what was called for in the outline in that Davis report. So they said, well, you know, maybe you better get some outside consultants in on this. And we were, you know, we were all young. We were all in our 20s. And very, very, maybe John was the old man. I guess John might have been in his early 30s, Reinhardt. Mm-hmm. But the rest of us were in our mid to late 20s and, you know, I hadn't had all that much experience. So we got, we got Raymond Loy and we got George Walker. Mm-hmm. And we got my brother-in-law, Wally Ford. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple others that had formed their own design team that had worked for Kaiser.
Oh, yeah.
The Henry J. Mm-hmm. A fellow named Buzz Grissinger.
Right.
And, they all submitted, well, before they submitted their ideas, Barley had a great idea. He said, there's going to be an awful lot of bias thrown into the selection of the final car here, unless we can neutralize it. And I said, well, you know, great. How do we neutralize a bias towards Raymond Loewy or George Walker, to, you know, name some of the more prominent names? Well, he laid out a grid where you had a straight on front view, side view, three quarter front, three quarter rear. And he picked a color, body color. It was a blue. And with the ground rules that were given to each of these outside consultants was that, number one, their car had to fall within the limits laid out on his grid. Mm-hmm. They had to be painted, all of them, so there couldn't be any fancy airbrush work and one of them come up with a spectacular color that might be more appealing. They were all uniform in color. They were all done in this blue. And nobody would sign their names to them. They had to be numbered. And I thought it was a great idea.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, our entry was put in with all the others.
Mm-hmm.
And we finally got them all assembled. We got all the outside people's work in. And needless to say, we were refining our own the whole time. But for the first car that we originally looked at internally, that we all thought was pretty close to what we wanted, oddly enough, didn't have a tire in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this seemed kind of a departure to come up with a Lincoln Continental that didn't have a rear-mounted spare tire. But the proportions of the car were great.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we thought, okay, this is good. This is the right kind of grill, and it's the right proportion of greenhouse to sheet metal, and we liked everything about it. But we had to incorporate the tire on it. And most of our early designs, it had exterior-mounted tires like the original Lincoln Continental did. And we took this thing, stuck it inside the trunk, and molded the sheet metal around the tire.
Okay.
And
whose idea was that? Could you pinpoint it?
No, I couldn't. I don't know whether I had. I felt that, you know, that was one of the cues of the mark.
Sure.
That it had to have it.
Right.
And you know, whether I insisted on that or whether John did, I really don't know. But I do remember that, you know, oddly enough, the original thing that we looked at, we thought, oh, okay, this is the car. But where's the tire? No. They were afraid that I wasn't going to like that car because it did not have the tire.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember with, you know, kind of great trepidation, they approached me and said, well, you know, we've looked at all the designs and refined all the lines. And so I said, I'd been working at it. I'd work every night for hours with John.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, you're going to like this, but... And of course, the butt was that there was no tire. Well, anyway, we managed to work the tire in there. And then we.
The obvious inference would be that you would say, well, look, we really should have a tire for a Continental.
Yeah. But we weren't really quite sure how to go about doing it. How to put the tire. If we mounted the tire externally, it didn't look right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And we just fiddled around with it and finally, okay, let's stick it in the trunk and mold the sheet metal around it.
It's a glorious inspiration.
Yeah, it was fine. It was pretty impractical because. You know, one of the things that I guess I insisted on, that everybody else did too, really, but was one of my things that I refused to depart from, was that everything on the car had to be functional.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't want a phony imprint of a tire if there was no tire there.
Right.
So we stuck the tire there. Now, you know, as far as loading luggage and everything else, it was a pain to have to load it over that tire. It wasn't too practical, but it...
It gave you lots of trunk space.
Yeah, well, it justified our putting the shape in the sheet metal of the deck lid. Well, so, you know, I'll never forget it. We told the design committee, which was, you know, Henry and Ernie and Jack Davis and the rest of them. We took them in. I conducted a tour with them individually and asked them when they left to please not discuss it with other members of the committee. I would make notes on all of their, with each one of them, their comments on the design. I would ask them to pick 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
And they obviously had no idea who'd done what, because they say they were numbered, and that was the only clue they had. I was the only one who had the keys to what the numbers were, who'd done what. And please don't talk to anybody else so you don't influence their decisions. Well, by the time my brother Ben was part of that group too.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we finished, I think there were 7 of them that looked at it. And, you know, oddly enough, I mean, our choice was picked unanimously.
Yeah.
And I think it was Well, I know it. I can't say it surprised us that much because we thought we were the best. Mm-hmm. But I know it sure surprised them.
And then you came out and announced that the one that they picked unanimously was
That was in-house. Yeah, that in-house was ours. One, yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, and I've never seen so many shocked people in my life.
They didn't accuse you of rigging. They couldn't.
No, they couldn't. No, I mean, it was the most honest competition you could ever think of. I mean, everybody got an equal shot. Everybody's car was, as I say, painted the same color. It all fit the same grid. There was no cheating on anything.
What happened to those competing designs? Did you keep them for a while?
Yeah, but I have no idea really what happened to them.
You didn't see what they looked like.
Yeah, I may have some lying around the house. I'm not sure.
If you do, that'd be great.
Yeah, I'll look and see whether I do or not.
Well, now, what was the date of this historic decision?
Well, this must have been about late 52, early 53, I would guess.
Early 53.
Yeah, because we were looking at a fall of 55
introduction
date, right.
You had a number of prototypes floating around. I recall seeing one called the... pictures of one called the 1900X.
Yeah, X. Yeah, that's right. That's right. 1500X or, yeah, that's right.
And several of them that you had.
Yeah, well, that was with Harley's chassis, and we took existing Lincoln sheet metal and, carved it all up and stretched it. And,
right.
And we used Hess and Eisenhart down in Cincinnati to make the prototypes.
Oh, good.
For us.
Good. You did.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah, right.
You about this time, or a few months later, you have a new official announcement of the Special Product Division organization, and I have a blue letter here which notes that you signed it, of course. And Harley Kopp is continuing as chief product engineer. Douglas Holmes is the financial man.
Right.
Charlie DeVos as the manufacturing planning.
Right.
Ray Hulsey is the purchasing.
Right.
And Doug McClure is a familiar name as your salesman.
Right.
And William Wallace is administrative assistant. And you mentioned William Wallace, I think, at one point, that he was interesting. Am I mistaken?
No.
No, it wasn't Wallace.
No.
Russell Smith, who is your industrial relations representative.
Right.
So you had a full-fledged, fully approved division.
Yes, we did.
And were you about to graduate from the trade school physically about this time, or was that a couple years later?
That was still a little ways away because we had to build the assembly plant on Oakwood Boulevard, and there was a big fuss about that too, site location. And we got Adele Arter, who was then the corporate vice president of manufacturing, and we had to get involved with Adele Arter and the plant engineering people, and what was a suitable site, and. Of course, they all had contingency plans. I'm sure they knew we were going to fall on our face, so in the event that we fell on our face, what could this property be used for? Were we going to run into political problems because it wasn't part of Dearborn, it was Allen Park? And, oh, Lord, we went through, seemed to me, more unnecessary delays and red tape. But
it was company property.
No, I think, well, it might be. I guess it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess it was.
Inside Allen Park.
That's right. And that was, there was some, what was the fuss about that? Something about the tax base of Allen Park that, we were the first industrial plant in there, and oh Lord, I don't know. We had the officials from Allen Park come in and assure us there wasn't going to be any change in the assessments, and we had to go through more rigmarole. But that plant was, I remember when it was finished because I went over to Europe that summer. That's the Grouse thing you were talking about. We were over shooting, and that was in the summer of 54. And I remember we were flying back into Detroit, and we'd been gone for a couple of weeks. Everybody was dying to get home. I said, let's fly over the plant and see what it looks like. Well, I mean, everybody in the plane thought it was absolutely nuts. let's land, we're finally home. I said, no, we gotta fly around, see what it looks like from the air. So we flew around the plant on Oakwood Boulevard, and it made great progress, and I could see that, we were gonna move in there before too long, so.
We had a pretty good team, this group, by and large, this group that you announced in 53, a pretty good team.
Oh, it was a wonderful team, and the esprit de corps that they had, and still have. I still hear from them. And, I got a letter from just the day before yesterday. A guy that used to work for Doug Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
And he's retired now, but he wants to get a Lincoln Town Car. And he was reminiscing about the days in the Continental Division. So there's a great bond there of all the people that used to work there.
Well, I think largely one of the great bonds was your personality and the fact that you felt you were a part of a group that was really going to accomplish something.
Well, it was great fun because number one, it was all new. We were totally in uncharted waters. We really didn't know where we were going. I had an idea rattling around in the back of my head through this whole thing of what I wanted the car to look like. And I was able to transmit that to some of the other people around that, okay, we're going to get this thing and we're going to do it right. And I'll know when I see it, and I've got some ideas. And when we get it, it's going to be the car that we all want it to be. And everybody, you couldn't ask enough of them. You didn't have to ask them. They'd volunteer. They'd right. work any kinds of hours, all hours, day and night, Saturdays, Sundays. They're really dedicated to the thing. And to make it was a great opportunity for everybody because they all were young. And here was a name for them a way for them to, make a name for themselves.
Well, John Reinhardt indicated in his interview that this was very much the case, that there was a great esprit de corps, and it was largely due to your wonderfully supportive.
Well, that's nice to hear, right?
Yeah. And he said it was a joy working with you. And he said he never had a better experience in life.
Well, I think we all had a good time. Yeah. We're a very compatible group, and it was a learning experience for all. We learned every day from each other.
Right, yeah.
And Harley, I'll give Harley full marks. He was, of course, being an engineer, he at least had some sense of what he had to accomplish from an engineering point of view. The rest of us were kind of batting around in the dark and really not knowing, what was going to come up next.
Right.
And in the process of designing it, we went through all kinds of gimmicks. We went to, maybe John told you about this, there's a 3D where we had the, corporate design committee, again, Henry and Ben and Ernie Breach and Jack Davis wearing these 3D glasses, and we were showing them little models and they were putting their glasses on. And we used, we were very creative. This was rather than go to the expense of building a full-size clay, we built 10th model clays. And we built everything to scale. We built people standing by the cars that were 10th scale. And it was a lot cheaper, a lot quicker, and a lot of everything else. We took them in, put the 3D glasses on them, and showed them these things. And, as I think back now that we're starting to talk about it, things are coming back to me that I haven't thought about in years. And some of the gimmicks and some of the tricks that we used to try and sell our product. And probably the toughest selling job was selling it to our own management. Forget the public. That was.
I wanted to ask you some of the byplay that went on at that point. Your relationship with Ernie Breach, of course, was probably very good, and Henry was undoubtedly supportive. Were there others like Louis Crusoe or others who sort of cast a jaundiced eye?
Louis Crusoe was starting to look at us with a very jaundiced eye. He was just starting to put together his own empire, and of course he put together the Ford division. He had his eyes on Lincoln Mercury. He was about to take them over. And he wanted to pull us into his fold, too.